City Hall is fighting a lawsuit challenging Terrence Freeman's eligibility to serve as a public official. A Neptune Beach board says no to a controversial new project. And the Florida Times Union newsroom says yes to a union. All of that and more just ahead. Good morning. It's Friday, and thanks for listening as we are live once again from Studio 5 for First Coast Connect this morning. The full hour today is devoted to our very popular Friday Media Roundtable. You can get on the line now at 549-2937 as we talk about all the biggest stories of the week. Here this Friday, Andrew Pantazzi, reporter for the Florida Times Union. Good morning.
Good morning.
Folio Weekly editor Claire Goforth is here.
Good to be here.
Angela Spears, host of Jax Engage on 94.7 FM.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Beaches leader columnist John McGowan.
Good morning.
Good to see all four of you. Thanks for being here. And lots to talk about this week on the roundtable. Lots of news. Everything from a new developer buying up a big downtown property that has sat vacant for years to another development getting shot down at the beaches this week. Also, the Times Union is going union. We'll tell you about that, too. All of that ahead. But first this morning, our top story. City Hall is weighing in on a flap over a newly appointed member of the Jacksonville City Council. Now, lawyers for the city filed a motion to become a defendant in the lawsuit by former school board member Brenda Priestley Jackson. Priestley Jackson sued Governor Rick Scott and newly appointed City Councilman Terrence Freeman over Scott's appointment of Freeman to be the councilman for District 10 on Jacksonville's Northwest Side. The reason she sued? Freeman didn't live in the district. He was living in Mandarin when the governor announced his appointment. Now, the lawsuit says that that made Freeman ineligible to serve. According to state law, an appointment is official when announced by the governor. The general counsel's office says, according to the city charter, Freeman is eligible to be a city councilman because he established residence before he was sworn in. Of course, Freeman was appointed by the governor after a couple of city council members, Reggie Brown and Katrina Brown, got caught up in a federal probe and are facing federal indictments and were suspended from their roles on the council. So Terrence Freeman held a town hall last night in his brand new district and took some heat from constituents who have expressed frustration with the appointment. We begin the hour with a closer look at this. What are your thoughts about this? Give us a call. It's a little complicated to follow, but we'll break down the chain of events here. The number to join us is 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And we always welcome your comments on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Angela Spears, let's begin with you. Terrence Freeman, well-connected Republican who hails from Mandarin, was appointed by the governor to replace Reggie Brown, the indicted District 10 Democratic councilman. He began renting a couple of rooms for his family in the district the same day he was appointed. And we've since learned he has actually changed residences in District 10 since then. He also had a town hall last night to sort of meet and greet his new constituents. So this is where we are with all of this right now. Why do you think this continues to be such a talker and a bone of contention for people?
Talking with various people, they simply want someone, Melissa, who is from their district in the office. And that's, as you've been saying, that's been the big contention of why can't you find someone in the district? I was talking with several people and they said it's not the fact that he's a Republican from another district that some feel that's disenfranchisement, right? But there are other Republicans in District 10 that the governor could have appointed, mm-hmm. bottom line. And so why wasn't that done? Why wasn't a person in the district looked into? Why wasn't that person appointed?
And a number of people applied to become this person, get this appointment.
From District 10.
Yeah.
And that's the whole thing, is that people want someone from their district, someone who knows the district, who understands the district and what's needed in that area.
Brenda Priestley Jackson made these arguments in her lawsuit, Andrew Pantazzi. She's suing the governor and Freeman in his official capacity, and Freeman is a private individual, although he does hold a public role now, saying that the residency requirements need to be followed. The normally conservative editorial page of the Florida Times Union the other day published a stinging rebuke to the governor about this. Really unusual to see from your paper.
Yeah, the editorial board, I think, has taken a strong stance in line with what a lot of District 10 residents seem to be saying, which is that they want to be represented by someone who comes from their district. The legal question here has to do with when he was appointed. The governor's press release when they announced this announced that he was appointed as of one day. The city is saying that you need to wait until the day he was sworn in and that he was able to move in before his swearing in day. That's language that seems to be missing from the city charter. And so that's where now the city's argument in their motions is that the Duval court, the circuit court, doesn't have jurisdiction, that this is an issue that is left up to the legislative body that should not be decided by a judge at all, that they should not be weighing in.
John McGowan, what are your thoughts about the city of Jacksonville getting involved in this lawsuit?
Well, that's a very logical step. I mean, basically, they're questioning the judgment of the city council and swearing him in. So having the city council step into the, or the city attorney step into this is the logical step. And their charter section, I mean, you've got it right here. It actually says Section 507 of the charter says the city council is specifically empowered to and has specific and exclusive jurisdiction to judge council members' qualifications. This is a, there's two lawsuits going on, and both of them have the common theme of which legal statute are you using? Are you going by the state standard, or are you going by the city charter and the city ordinances? And that's what the cases are going to be argued. So what the city's going to be saying is that it is the city charter has precedent over this, and I think they have, that's an accurate argument.
There's another case that comes to mind that may have set the precedent, the late Jay Jabbour. Do you remember him? He owned Carl's Clothiers. He ran into a residency flap like this, and he was ultimately ruled, I believe, ineligible.
After he had been elected. That was in 2007, and it was determined by a judge using things like where he was getting his homestead exemption. They were looking at a bunch of property records that they essentially invalidated his election, but saying that he wasn't qualified for the at-large seat. So even there, it wasn't a district seat, but rather an at-large seat.
Well, at-larges are done by districts as far as where you can live. But the difference with Jay was he was running for it. And when you run for it, there are qualifications that you have to have a residency established certain amount of time before you qualify, before you take office. And for an appointment, that standard does not exist. And that's where we're seeing this conversation. And really, ultimately, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter whether they win this case or not. If they succeed and Terrence Freeman's removed from the city council, he's already now an established resident. The governor can simply write a new executive order and reappoint him.
That is true.
They're suing over basically 12 hours. And it's a 12-hour distinguishment of whether was when he established that residency. Did he have it established in the morning, or did he have it established in the afternoon? That's what a small time frame it is.
And what time do you check into an Airbnb? But seriously, though, I do think that state law will supersede in this case. And I think that the reason they're suing, it's not so much about the 12 hours. It's really about the spirit of what has happened here. People feel as though Terrence Freeman doesn't really represent District 10, but we all know that politicians often move specifically to establish residency in order to run for office because they tend to pick districts where it's favorable to them, to whatever political belief they have. The difference in this case is that the governor has taken it upon himself to appoint someone to a seat who was not a resident of that district a day prior. When the voters choose to elect someone who wasn't a resident prior to qualifying, prior to that period of time, that's a choice that they get to make. So I think that is why people take such issue with this appointment.
Couldn't this have all been avoided, everyone, if Reggie Brown would have just resigned? I know we are where we are, but if he would have resigned, then it would have gone to the people, to the voters, and they would have been able to vote in whoever they wanted to. They would have been able to get someone from their district rather than having the governor appoint someone.
Right. Both Reggie Brown and Katrina Brown refused to resign.
And sometimes resigning doesn't mean you're guilty. Sometimes it means you're doing the best thing for the people.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to some calls. It's our Friday Media Roundtable for the full hour this morning. I like saying that. Remember how Tim Russert used to do that on Meet the Press? For the full hour! Anyway, 549-2937. Tom on the West Side. Hi, Tom. Good morning.
Good morning to you, too. And, my comment is, I just see this as part of a pattern from both our governor and our mayor. I mean, our mayor started with reappointing and forcing people out of his boards. And our governor has got his judicial appointment where he's also seeking to disenfranchise us and appoint someone before an actual election. It's, like I say, they just do not respect the will of the voters, and they're just pushing people. Also, let me add quickly that anyone who really, really believes that he's established residence in his new community is naive. I mean, 2 rooms for a family? That's ridiculous.
Okay, thanks, Tom. And we're getting a tweet about this. It's actually from Lisa King, who chairs the local Democratic Party. She points out on Twitter, the city did not intervene in the Jay Jabbour case, the case we were talking about a few minutes ago. So, okay, is the city getting too involved in efforts to weigh in on these appointments, not only to boards and commissions, such as the caller mentioned, but these positions on the city council?
I mean, arguably, the city shouldn't have a dog in the fight over who specifically is chosen for District 10. It should remain neutral in that process. And I think that some people may be frustrated with the reality that we're all paying for the city to litigate this matter.
Yeah, I mean, the decision was made by the governor. It was not made by the mayor. It was not made by city officials. So there is a question. I think I can understand why the city is getting involved, saying since we are litigating something that has to do with the city charter. But the decision ultimately came out of the governor's office. So it'll be interesting to see how the judge weighs in and what happens with their motion to dismiss, saying that the court does not have jurisdiction over something like this, especially when in the Jay Jabbour case, there was a court that weighed in.
Well, and don't get too fixated on the tactics that are used in a court case. It is a tactic, and they're going to file motions, and there's going to be motions to dismiss. And you see this, and not to equate the two, but you'll see this in a criminal case where there'll be motions to dismiss over different things, and they're always looking for a reason to win. And you can't always equate what a lawyer's doing to win a case with necessarily what the reality is. Sometimes they're just going to be filing motions and trying to do things. So if you try and watch play-by-play of it.
The difference with government lawyers and private lawyers is that the city lawyers essentially work for the citizens of Jacksonville. And so their task is not necessarily to delay in order to win a case. I don't think they should have a stance that is looking at this as winning means getting the lawsuit against the governor dismissed, but rather what is the letter of the law and how can we ensure that the letter of the law is being upheld?
I agree that they should be upholding the letter of the law, but I disagree that they should not be using their attorneys. Their job is to represent their clients.
If you file frivolous motions, eventually you can be sanctioned, though. I mean, you can't just keep filing motion with no legal grounds.
Yeah, I mean, but this is only one motion, and you're going to see different tactics that are going to be used to try and gain some ground here. And that is their client, which is the city of Jacksonville, believes. And you can say whether it's the constituents or the residents or whatever, but the city of Jacksonville believes that Terrence Freeman is a legit city councilman, and that is their stance, and they're arguing to legitimize that he is a councilman.
As this fight goes on, I just want to take a moment to call attention to Mark Wood's column on all of this the other day. A very cheeky Mark Woods lately, by the way, in the Florida Times Union. A little bit of a District 10 quiz for Mr. Freeman and anyone else who lives in that district. And these are questions that you would think anyone who lives in this district and represents it should know.
Okay.
Angela Spears and others on the panel.
I don't live in District 10. No,
you don't
I'm
live
just
in District 10. No. But here are some of the questions. What body of water forms a border of District 10? The Trout River, the Atlantic Ocean, Lake Okeechobee, or Julington Creek? And it goes on from there. I think everyone should take a look at that. Kind of cute. But it just points to the fact that we've had these residency flaps before. This isn't new.
Do you think this will galvanize? And I think it will. It will galvanize people to get out there and really vote, to know that their vote matters overall when you're looking at the big picture of saying, hey, I want my person in to make sure something like this doesn't happen again.
It certainly could have that effect.
But the person they chose.
You couldn't vote
was
on them.
Was Reggie Brown.
Yeah.
And that was the person they chose. And they galvanized behind him because they felt like they didn't know all the information. They didn't know what was going on behind the scenes. They didn't know the larger picture of it. So
I almost feel like that's not even the right issue, in that it's not a question of whether Terrence Freeman is a good or a qualified city councilman.
Because he's very qualified and he's very good.
And I've not heard anyone argue differently than that. The question is, Jacksonville is the largest landmass city in the 48 states. And because of that, the differences between South Mandarin below Greenland and 20 miles away in District 10 are vast. That we are a city of neighborhoods. And when we consolidated the government, there was an understanding that you would have districts that were representative of the different neighborhoods, and the city council people from those neighborhoods would know what is unique to a place on the west side in northwest Jacksonville and what is unique to South Mandarin and the development and the what's going on in, you know, Joynton Creek and on the other side of the county line. There's different issues in each part of Jacksonville, and the city council is supposed to be made up of people who know what is unique to their neighborhoods, in addition to being qualified and good at their job. So if the voters of District 10 vote for someone who does or is alleged to commit a federal crime and is removed from office, they still had the right to vote for someone who came from their neighborhood.
But let's go, speaking of Mandarin, let's go to David in Mandarin. Hey, David, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you. It was stated that the attorney works for the citizens, as it sounded like plural group of Jacksonville. An attorney cannot operate and have more than one person as a client. The client tells him the instructions. The unique client tells him what the client wants accomplished. That's the person that sent him. And that's been the total problem in Jacksonville, in the sense of our stable of attorneys. Even the supervisor of election is not the client of the attorney sent from the mayor or whoever's sending them to the independent agencies. And that we've seen fights at the school board, supervisor of election before, and that's what it's all about. Because the elected official that we chose cannot do the job he promised because the attorney will not support him in it. And that's been the problem in Jacksonville forever, and we're never going to change and become a city instead of a bill until we have that problem solved.
All right, David. Claire, our attorney on the panel today, your thoughts?
The token attorney.
Yes.
There is definitely going to have to be someone giving the city attorney direction. But I do disagree that the city attorney represents the people of Jacksonville. There are government attorneys. I mean, the state attorney's office comes to mind, various prosecutors. Functionally impossible for an attorney to take the poll of the voters, I suppose, and see what the people want them to do. They do need to be taking some direction, which maybe leads us to the conclusion that the city's decision is being made by the executive, which would be the mayor.
All right. And if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable for the full hour today as we break down the biggest stories of the week. Give us a call now as we move forward at 549-2937. Now, also catching our eye this week, a big story out at the beaches. The Neptune Beach Community Development Board voted unanimously, 6-0, during its meeting Wednesday night to deny a proposed new development called 500 Atlantic at the site of the old Kmart right there near the beach. The vote came after the board spent more than 4 hours listening to impassioned public comment from people who packed the auditorium at Fletcher High School. The vast majority were opposed to this development. Of course, the Neptune Beach City Council will have the final say, but John McGowan, strong opposition to this development at the beaches. As a beaches resident, what are your thoughts?
It's a study of not in my backyard, for sure.
Exactly.
It is. It was an interesting to watch the... I was at the community development board meeting. it was interesting to watch because nobody, the two sides were not arguing for the vote. We knew how the vote was going to go when you walked in. The presentation had nothing to do with the six members of the Community Development Board. It was a presentation for when the developer sues the city later. And that's all it was. And it was very interesting to watch. And the community is going to celebrate right now. They feel good. They got that 6-0 win. But there's a very common theme at the beach where the planning commissions and the community development boards will vote a certain way because the community wants it. And then the attorneys will tear them up in court later. So they're enjoying the honeymoon right now, but it's still got to go before the council. The council is going to 100% vote against it. There's no doubt in my mind that's going to go the same way where everybody votes against the new development. But it was interesting to watch. But the community is very united on this. It was in the room, probably 75% were adamantly no, and 25% were yes. I don't know how many of those people were Neptune Beach residents versus Atlantic Beach and Jack's Beach, but it was very lopsided that they did not want this development. I don't know what they want, and that's part of the problem.
Right,
they know what they don't want, but they don't know what they want.
They didn't want an apartment complex with 175 units, a boutique hotel, and some more retail space. So the argument against was too much density, too much traffic adding to that little small town feel that people like in Neptune Beach. Even the police chief voiced concerns about it.
I was just going to comment on that. They want that small town feel. And you always see that, Melissa, with the beaches community, right? What's up for some people. Remember, there have been times when they've tried to hold big festivals there. And the community, you're living out there in the beach, you simply don't want the traffic. You don't want all the people here in Jacksonville, right? We want the people, right? We want all the people to come. We want those big festivals. But that's not the feel that's wanted in that area. So it will be interesting to see what do people really want to go in that old parking lot, because you don't want it to become an eyesore.
It's an empty, abandoned Kmart. And it's, how long has it been sitting there?
Oh, it's been years.
Years. Okay, years. Andrew.
Yeah, it's been sitting there for years. I don't live at the beach. I don't go to the beach very often. I assume that most of the six members of the Neptune Beach board were residents of Neptune Beach when they voted on this. So I think I will defer to the beaches, the local
beaches residents
here.
Yes, okay. Claire,
I will add that I think that the issue with the Gate gas station and that that loss that a lot of people viewed as one of the driving forces to sort of sweep house afterwards in the elections may have factored into the decision for them to vote against this development, because I know that the Beaches Diner was very celebratory after those elections. Because they had lost that battle with the Gate gas station.
Give us a call, especially if you're at the beaches, and let us know how you feel about this. Do you live at the beach because you like its small town character? What are your motivations for living at the beach, besides the obvious one of being near the ocean? And what are your thoughts about this development and more density coming to the beaches? Because certainly more developers are going to be eyeing other parcels as the community grows. The number to join us is 549-293. Andrew,
I was going to say, alternatively, if you're from District 10 and you want to weigh in on what the beach should do because you feel like you're qualified and feel like you can move over there real quick, then you should do
good
so.
Good point.
Why don't you just stay at the
density issue, and you brought up the festivals, and that's been an issue of mine as well. When you bring in more people, it does put more burden on the resources, especially with the law enforcement. That was what Chief Pike brought up, was that he felt that this was that they needed to increase their police department by two officers. Not specifically for this development, but they needed two officers anyhow. We're a city of 23,000 in Jacksonville Beach, but on the weekends we get into closer to 50 to 100,000 people are there on top of our population. And that is a strain on a police department that is built around a population of 23,000. So that's where you start getting into talking about festivals, talking about crowd. Then you start getting to density issues. What's that going to do to traffic? Jacksonville Beach is pretty much built out. Neptune Beach is pretty much built out. You're not going to see a lot of these battles coming up because of the zoning. So what you're seeing here is this is a battle that's zoned commercial, and they're looking to use a special exception to make it a mixed use, that's the only time you're going to see a density change. Everything else is single family, and there's no really vacant properties left out there.
And let's talk about the fact, too, that there is an ordinance at our beaches communities that you can't build, you can't have a South Florida style high rise that blots out the sun right up against the sand. You don't see very tall buildings in our beaches communities.
Three stories is our limit on all the beach cities.
Right. And so over and over again, what I've observed from beaches residents is this really strong desire to preserve that livability, which is kind of unique among Florida beaches communities. You don't often see that. If you go down to South Florida, it's a completely different world at the beach than what you see here. And it's really almost a hidden little pocket of laid back beach living that's becoming increasingly rare in Florida. And so I wasn't surprised to see that opposition the other night.
Yeah, and I've actually lived at the beach. It was technically Ponte Vedra, but it was right on right on the line of Jacksonville Beach. And it was in an apartment complex, and it was, you know, it was really excellent to live near the beach and to really enjoy that residential character, riding your bicycle around and just feeling like part of the fabric of a small town community out at the beach. I mean, we joke about the ditch on either side of it, but there's a very real cohesion that you find at the beach.
Let's go to David in Neptune Beach right now. Hi, David. Happy Friday. Good morning. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, how are you guys?
Happy okay.
Friday.
You too.
Happy Friday.
The one thing that I think, I was there the other night, and the one thing that I think we're kind of dancing around and maybe just needs to be said and then addressed is really the pedestrian safety issue or lack thereof on A1A and 3rd Street. You know, I think with some of the new development at Atlantic and 3rd Street, you know, the pedestrian kind of traffic around that area has gotten greater. And then I think with this, you know, there's some concern about what the pedestrian traffic is going to be at Lemon Street. And I think that was kind of a key moment of the police chief's testimony when he talked about kind of pedestrian traffic and what they were going to do with Lemon Street when more people are trying to cross without a crosswalk.
Yeah. Oh, thanks for that. John.
Well, That is a concern we have at the beach, but it's a concern that the entire city of Jacksonville has. If we can go back, put this on a broader issue, is jaywalking was an issue, and that became the Times Union and the sheriff got into a big disagreement over writing tickets for jaywalking. That is a problem we have at the beach for sure. We don't have the police resources to really crack down on it, but I've been riding with the Jacks Beach Police Department two times. Two different years where somebody got hit by a car running across A1A. It is a real problem in the city. It's a real problem not just at the beach, but citywide, where pedestrians are getting hit by cars because they're not following the traffic laws. You don't want to walk that extra block to get to a crosswalk. You don't want to walk that extra block to the safety. You want to Frogger it and you get hit. And that's an issue that's really, it's not specific to this. It's citywide. And then if you write tickets for it, you get hit by the Times Union for being racist.
Well, I think you're conflating a couple of things there, but I completely take your point. And if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable as we talk about the biggest stories of the week with John McGowan, Claire Goforth, Angela Spears, and Andrew Pantazzi. Give us a call at 549-2937.
And I will say, John is standing athwart every possible pedestrian safety expert who would say that ticketing does nothing to preserve or increase pedestrian safety, but rather that infrastructure is the only answer. And so if you are relying upon ticketing as your means of pedestrian safety, if you could point to any experts.
There's a balance. I mean, you've got to build in that. You mean you've got to have the crosswalks. You've got to have places for the pedestrians to cross. But how do you change the behavior
of the pedestrians?
Of the pedestrians. How do you change the behavior of the pedestrians?
I think that every expert, and again, if you know of experts, if I'm wrong, if you have,
I wasn't prepared to dig into this subject. We were talking about Kmart, Common sense tells you that if you're going to get a ticket for doing something, you're less inclined to do it. That's why you don't speed. That's why you don't run stop signs.
You don't speed?
Actually, no. He's the only one.
I really don't.
I John's common sense aside, what pedestrian safety experts say, in contradiction to John's common sense, is that, in fact, it is infrastructure builds that changes people's behavior.
And I'm not saying one over the other. I'm saying they got to go. They have to go together. But you tell me the police.
And how do you see the infrastructure at the beach, both of you guys, in terms of being able to sustain the growing density that we're seeing?
So, I mean, I think that's where wide roads, I think that's where a lack of crosswalks. If you have to walk really far to get to a crosswalk to cross the street, are you going to do that? Or are you going to cross the busy wide roads over at the beach? It's about designing ways for pedestrians to get from one side of the road to the other.
I would make the case that our infrastructure citywide is woefully inadequate task.
One of the problems we have at the beach is A1A is a state road. So the beach cities and the county really have no input on what's going on. There's a push by Atlantic Beach right now to narrow Mayport Road, reduce the speed limit, add some extra lanes, and make it a little more pedestrian friendly because they have a high, high volume of people getting hit. A1A, we're working on a crosswalk in Jack's Beach, but FDOT's got to fund that. We had it funded a few years ago, and that fell through. At Lemon Street, there was a conversation to have that done. That was supposed to be partially funded. So there are different pieces going on here.
And let's go to Chuck at the beaches now. Hey, Chuck, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, guys.
Hey.
I'll be quick. I grew up on San Pablo Road, where Greenfield Staples was, which is now Queens Harbor. There was 3 square miles of woods, and there were 3 houses there. You know what Queens Harbor is now. You know what all of the developments are there now. And so I guess my question to your guests are, you want to put a pool in your backyard. You want to put an addition on your house. You deal with these things. You want to build a 3-story building in Neptune Beach. What rights do you as a homeowner or the people who own the property who want to develop it have? Again, you know what Queens Harbor looks like.
Mm-hmm.
That was 3 square miles of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you might be able to see my point. What rights, and I live there on those in the middle of the woods, and it's okay. I understand it's a great place now. That's progress. What rights do the property owners have versus your neighbors in the city?
Okay, Chuck. Yeah, thanks for that.
Yeah, the push and pull between property owners and zoning is something that's been going on for hundreds of years and is continuing present day and at the beach. I think, you know, when you're representing a city, you're trying to make decisions that are the best for all of the people. And that includes the property owner who may want to build something that other residents are not a fan of. And it's a balancing act. You know, if somebody wanted to put a 50-story high skyscraper at that Kmart, obviously that would alter the character fundamentally of the beach.
And and you would see enormous pushback.
And these are all growing pains, right? This is signs of growth. I always say with the city of Jacksonville, when you see all the traffic, when you see the cones, when you see the construction, that's a sign of growth. And that's a good thing. But in this area, some people don't want that growth.
Brian tweets the show, Jacksonville roads seem as if they were built with the assumption that pedestrians don't exist. David tweets the show, there is a lack of crosswalks at the beach, huge medians in the way. And as we continue to talk about this, the number to join us is 549-2937. But we also want to make note of another headline this week. While the Neptune Beach development hit a big snag, another one is finally moving ahead, it seems. There is a new owner announced for the partially built Berkman Plaza 2 building on the North Bank in downtown Jacksonville. That's the half-built tall building. You've seen it as you've driven by the jail and downtown Bay Street. It's known as the Beirut Berkman.
The big eyesore.
It looks like it's bombed out Beirut.
It's the great eyesore that at every Jags game, when they need a good shot of Jacksonville, they look at that and then they say, what's another eyesore we can look at? And they look at the landing.
That's right. Now, the new owner.
You're on it today, aren't you?
The commonly referred to Berkman Plaza 2, Beirut Berkman, is 500 East Bay LLC. And what they want to do is turn this eyesore into a gleaming new hotel that would also feature what they call a family fun center that would draw families from miles around to come as a new attraction. Claire.
Finally, you know, but based on my knowledge of Jacksonville projects, I have a feeling I may qualify for AARP by the time this project is finished. I am not yet 40, y'all.
50 is the new 30, I'm just saying.
And it's a fabulous age.
Yes, it is.
But I think we can all agree that, you know, we're relieved that there's going to be some progress on the Beirut Berkman, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it is exciting to finally see someone buy it.
And it's exciting. It's good. I've been talking with people, and one of my friends told me just yesterday, he said, you know what? I'm skeptical, though, because we've heard this over the years. We've always tried to do something. He said, until I see the cranes in there moving, something happening, I'm going to be skeptical. But overall, I really do think this is a good thing because we need that eyesore fixed. We need that problem resolved. And I'm interested to see what's going to happen with that family fun zone and if it's going to be that tourist attraction.
Sure.
I said this before we went on the air, but the race is on between the East San Marco Publix and the Berkman 2 to see which will actually be completed. But in all honesty, especially in light of the tragedy that did happen at Berkman 2 10 years ago, in which the parking garage collapsed.
And it killed a worker and injured others.
It killed one
That's
of the workers.
It sat empty for so long because right after that came the housing crisis.
Which is why, as it moves forward, I hope that the workers have their safety in mind, that as construction begins, as they make new plans, that that can be a safe place for the workers and then eventually be a safe place for people to live and to interact.
Let's go to Jeff in Atlantic Beach right now. Hi, Jeff. You're on the radio. Hey. Go ahead.
Yeah, I live at the beaches, and I know it would be a lot of money, but it seems like the obvious solution would be a pedestrian bridge over A1A, and then the old Kmart area could be an extension of the town center, and you could have, you know, mixed use living there. And it seems, I mean, I don't think people are against development. It's just, you know, more town center would be great, but just tons of more people being there, living there, I don't think the beaches are excited about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for that. What about that? John McGowan, a pedestrian bridge. And just add to the town center, where Neptune and Atlantic Beach meet. That's the corner we're talking about.
I don't think a pedestrian bridge is going to fly out there. I think that it's an idea that people will talk about, but you're looking at I don't know how they build it. Traditionally, my understanding is they aren't very well used when they're built. And the feeling I'm getting from the beach is that the pedestrian bridge is never going to be the answer. That's mm-hmm. just not going to catch on. It's going to be an eyesore.
Victor in Jacksonville Beach. Hello, Victor.
Thank you so much for taking my call. Regarding the growth of the beach, I'm so glad to live there. And I kind of feel bad that we almost feel like we have a house here. No one else can live here. Regarding the growth issue about the gentleman said Lime Street or even Beach Boulevard and A1A. We have 3 to 4 cops hanging out on Friday and Saturdays at every bar, making very good money. Why don't we put 1 or 2 of those cops on Lime Street and A1A? The people see the blue lights, they slow down. The people can cross by the blue lights and be safe. And the cities can save so much money. That's all I have.
Okay, thanks for that, Victor.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, all right. Now, another story that we want to mention that happened this week. The newsroom of the Florida Times Union voted to unionize. The final tally, 18-9, although 5 votes were contested and were actually not counted because they didn't change the outcome. The staff members of the TU, after many years of layoffs and staff reductions, have voted to join the News Guild, which is part of the Communications Workers of America. Andrew Pantazzi, you are one of the people who led this effort for your newsroom. Tell us more about it.
Yeah, so it was a month-long process after we went public. We've been in the process of gathering information and talking to the union since December, January, around that time, which is when 10 people were laid off, including your husband, Melissa.
Right.
And we were looking for representation, looking to get a contract that could offer stability for us. And a majority of the newsroom, 2/3, voted this in. every single person voted that was in town. There were three people out of town. And the five contested people, the only reason they're contested is it's unclear whether they should be considered management or the workers in a newsroom. The structure is very different than many other workplaces. So who is management and who is not is a difficult question that I genuinely don't know how the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, will rule. But we're very glad to have the union now. We're glad to be moving on. The next step of this process is going to be ensuring that we reach out, especially to people who may have said that they did not want the union, to make sure we hear their concerns. And that way we can stand together as one voice fighting for a fair and strong contract. I can understand many of the reasons why people voted no. Gatehouse, the investment firm that owns the Florida Times Union, promised they would give raises if we voted no.
2% raises.
Yeah, a 2% merit pool that would be budgeted for raises.
That would be the first raises at the Times Union in many years, correct?
Yes, yeah. They also promised that if we voted no, they would give us better severance. The reason I voted for the union in spite of that, I believe that what they are saying is illegal. The NLRB says you cannot provide benefits contingent on a union vote. I also believe that we need something that we can have that's a contract that's enforceable, not just them giving us promises that they can later withhold or later change. And so I am proud of my workers, of my coworkers who either voted for or against it. I'm very glad that we had 100% turnout, that everyone took an interest in this. Everyone wanted to make sure their voice was heard. And so the next step is going to be figuring out who is on the negotiating committee. And then sending out a survey so that everyone, again, regardless of how they vote, that they will have their voices heard in this survey about what they want to prioritize. And we can start working on a contract with Gatehouse to help ensure that the journalists in Jacksonville, the journalists at the Florida Times Union, can stay there long term, and that this is a place where journalists can build families and they can plan a long term future to be invested in this community.
That's amazing, because it's simply amazing, Melissa, when you and I worked together years ago at a certain...
First Coast News.
Okay. Yes, it was always a bad word when people mentioned union. You know, you just kind of didn't say that word around the newsroom.
Well, this is a right-to-work state. And, you know, by and large, most employees around this area are not members of a union. And even in northern states, union membership, of course, has declined a lot. But in recent decades. But what we've seen, particularly in the media business, are an increasing number of local and national publications turning to guilds like this because of the disruptions and the reductions in the industry.
And I think worker protections are an issue that we can talk about more broadly than even in the media, because they've been undermined for many years in America, and we see income disparity growing. And there's cause and effect there that we just keep sort of glossing over, and our leaders do not address. If you continually allow companies to pay their workers a substandard wage and not provide them with various benefits, and severance packages and certain things of that nature, maternity leave comes to mind, and health care and those type of things, and people are going to see their paychecks shrink and their disposable income shrink year after year, which does have an effect on the economy, and it has effect on quality of life.
And a quick break. We'll keep talking about this, and only in Florida, right after this.
Mayo Clinic, where medical experts work together across specialties to improve diagnosis and treatment for patients with the most complex conditions. More at mayoclinic.org/Florida.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. Medical malpractice issues are complex and require a special understanding of how to investigate and prove what went wrong. More at waynehogan.law.
I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, have you taken a peek at your family tree? Carl Zimmer has, and he says that if you trace it back, you may eventually run into Cleopatra, possible ancestor of all living humans. We'll talk with him about using the math of heredity. Plus, how astronomers unexpectedly found 12 more moons orbiting Jupiter. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Friday at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, scientific research about sleep, research that might keep you up at night. Matthew Walker, author of Why We Sleep, tells us why we need 8 hours, the alarming consequences when we don't get it, and what's going on in the brain when we sleep. At some stages of sleep, the brain is more active than when we're awake. He'll also give us some tips on how to get a good night's rest. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
How does the president really feel about Russia? After this week, it's hard to say.
It should have been obvious. I thought it would be obvious, but I would like to clarify just in case it wasn't.
Also, the student accused of being a Russian spy and the master of disguise who manipulated high-profile politicians. The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, in just a moment, we'll get to Only in Florida. But first, some of our esteemed panelists are going to tell us something we don't know. Angela Spears, let's start with you. What story did we miss this week?
Well, today is the renaming of the main post office downtown. It will be renamed after Rutledge Pearson, who was an educator, a civil rights leader, a human rights activist. But the ceremony will be held at City Hall at 10 o'clock this morning. So that's so exciting. And for me, what's exciting is that Mr. Rutledge Pearson's brother, Lloyd Pearson, is still alive, 96 years old.
Wow.
An amazing man who has so many stories, who registered thousands and thousands of people to vote over the years. He'll be there.
Wow.
As well, celebrating that.
Really exciting.
And Mr. Solly Mitchell, who you've had on your show, who just turned 100 years old, will be there. So those two historians
links to that era.
Yes.
Yeah.
That will be amazing.
What time is that today?
At 10 o'clock
at City Hall.
So right after the show, we're going to speed over there. Well, not speed.
Not speed.
Claire, John doesn't speed.
Yes. Claire Goforth, what do you got cooking?
Well, the Clay County Superintendent of Schools, Addison Davis, there's an inquiry in the police's language into whether or not he potentially harassed a constituent. A woman claims that he called her numerous times, which the phone records he provided to us do confirm that he called her numerous times on Sunday and Monday after she posted a Facebook article about his softball team, which had its championship taken from it after self-reporting that age ineligible players had been on the field.
A flap over softball.
Softball.
Didn't the sheriff dispute your story?
The sheriff then, after, yes, the sheriff did dispute our story, but then after I spoke with his spokesperson the following morning, and by that time their press release had been taken down off their website, the spokesperson admitted that, yes, there was an inquiry and took issue with whether or not the term investigation was proper.
Well, and I guess that comes down to if somebody files a complaint, they're going to go ask questions. Does that constitute a full investigation? Or are they just following up on the complaint and looking into it?
That's correct. It is definitely an issue of nomenclature.
All right.
And I think, lastly, I saw that the state has okayed funding to help ensure election security in light of the 2016 attempts to hack into county elections offices to infect their computers with malware. The state, I think just yesterday, okayed a lot of money to come from the federal government to go to those county elections offices.
And we'll be talking about that at 1 o'clock this afternoon on our new statewide program, the Florida Roundup, by the way. So
but
thank you for that.
Federally, the House said no to that.
That's true. The House in Washington, not the State House, U.S. House did vote that down. And finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state this week. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now as we close out the hour with Only in Florida. And only in Florida can you watch a Goliath grouper eat the shark you just caught. Did you guys hear about this? There's a reason Goliath groupers are called the garbage disposals of the sea. A group of fishermen saw a 500-pound grouper's meal during a fishing trip off the coast of Everglades City last week. Someone in the group caught a 3-foot shark, and as they started reeling it in, a large shadow appeared. They watched closely, then suddenly an open-mouthed giant Goliath grouper swam up and gulped down the entire shark. Can you imagine seeing that?
I think I know what type of fish swallowed Jonah.
Yes, a grouper, not a whale. Speaking of deadly critters, only in Florida do employees of a freight company find a 6-foot-long Burmese python on the job site. This happened down in Doral, Florida. The python was spotted at the loading dock of the freight company in a wheel well. There's a canal system in Doral that apparently runs directly to the Everglades. So there you go. Mm. And finally, only in Florida can you go to jail for picking up seashells. You can go to jail for this. The Miami Herald reports a woman from Dallas was arrested and charged last week after she was spotted taking 40 queen conch seashells from the waters surrounding Key West against the law.
She sells seashells.
She was planning to clean them up and sell them or give them as gifts, but taking a living queen conch is illegal, according to the state's Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission.
I've once picked up a shell and was very surprised when a hermit crab grabbed me by the finger. Oh. Let's just say I dropped it immediately.
And you haven't picked up a shell since.
That's right. I have not picked up a shell since.
See, we should have hermit crabs who are helping pedestrian safety.
That's a good idea, Andrew.
Thanks, you guys, so much for being here. For the full hour this Friday, John McGowan, Claire Goforth, Andrew Pantazzi, and Angela Spears, thanks for joining the show. And have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you. Have a good one, Melissa.
And that is our show. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Don't forget to join us at 1 o'clock this afternoon for our new statewide program, the Florida Roundup. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.